This past week, the Nobel laureate V.S. Naipaul was interviewed at the Royal Geographic Society in London about his phenomenal career, which spans six decades. It should have been a glorious moment. Instead, Cervidia told an interviewer that no woman could ever be his literary match. Then he singled out Jane Austen and said that he couldn't possibly share her sentimental ambitions, her sentimental sense of the world. Naipaul also called a book by his former female publisher Feminine Tosh, and that, he said, is because a woman has a, quote, narrow view of the world, since she is inevitably not a complete master of the house. This from a man the New York Review of Books called the greatest living master of English prose. If a misogynistic and contemptuous remark is uttered by someone who's won a Nobel Prize for literature, how might we react? Naipaul is famous or infamous for his fractious and ruinous relationships with other human beings, particularly women. One of his targets, the former British publisher, just laughed, taking the "he's just an old duffer" approach. But I'm not laughing. As a young traveler and writer, I remember savoring the precision of Naipaul's observances and anticipating each new book. If I'd known of his disturbing reputation with women at the same time, his wife, his mistress, he'd never have won me over. In an excellent essay, the novelist Roxana Robinson asks why we should put up with misogyny. She points at the truly disturbing gender imbalance in a raft of distinguished journals, like the New York Review of Books. This great gender imbalance in our best magazines is actually more important than Naipaul's dismissals. So, you have to blow the house down. We could look at the British explorers, Freya Stark or Gertrude Bell, since the knighted author was sitting at the Royal Geographic Society, which honored those women. Or we could turn to Jane Austen, who he slighted. Men have had every advantage of us in telling their own story, she wrote. Education has been theirs in so much higher a degree. The pen has been in their hands. I will not allow books to prove anything. It's as if the lady anticipated Naipaul's hubris. You're listening to NPR News. It's high school graduation season, an emotional time for many. In Goldsboro, North Carolina, the 60 graduating seniors at Wayne Early Middle College High School have formed a special bond. Dave DeWitt of North Carolina Public Radio has the story.
Nikea Randolph was 8 years old when she first heard Beethoven and fell in love with music.
I was amazed at the fact that so much self-expression and compassion can be expressed without words. From that point on, I kind of just, music became my everything. Music is my life.
Nikea decided early on she wanted to go to Juilliard, so she got up every day before school and practiced for 2 hours, then four more when she got home. She plays the piano, guitar, clarinet, drums, even the auto harp. And she writes her own music, too, like this. Nikea's father is a press operator at Georgia Pacific. Her mother works at a local high school. Nikea and her sister are the first in her family to go to college. Juilliard is a long shot for anyone, and Nikea had one distinct disadvantage. She didn't have a classical guitar, the kind she needed to play on her audition tape. That didn't sit well with Scott Hendrickson, a fellow senior.
I like to play music, I like to listen to music, but I noticed that the guitar she was playing, it just was not built for that kind of music. And I realized that somebody with that kind of musical potential deserves to have an instrument that can really take them that far.
So Scott sprang into action. He sent out a mass text message to his fellow seniors and asked for donations. The money came in quickly, $10 here, $2 there. He remembers how much it cost the penny, but he doesn't want Nikea to know. When he had enough, he drove an hour and a half to Raleigh and bought it.
I had the idea, I took the idea, and literally less than 24 hours, we had the guitar.
A few days later, he stood on a stage at the school's talent show and surprised Nikea with the guitar, a moment captured in a jumpy YouTube video.
She wants to go and see you do everything that you've always wanted to do. So we got you, Escort Dumbos, a handcrafted guitar in Oregon.
In the video, Nikea is overcome. Several months later, she still is.
When they got me that guitar, it makes me realize that they actually believed in my dreams and they want to help me accomplish my dreams.
If this was a fairy tale, Nikea would have made her audition tape for Juilliard, been accepted, and gone on to a life of red carpets and Grammy Awards. But it's not. Instead of a fat acceptance letter, Nikea got the thin one. Juilliard said no. Nikea was crushed for about 2 weeks, and then, like a musician, she turned her pain into art.
People ask, you know, let it out. Mom goes, let it out. You can cry. And I'm like, Mom, I don't want to cry. I just want my music. There's some times where I just want my music, and that was one of them.
Nikea will study music at Columbia College in South Carolina this fall on a scholarship. She wants to write music for movies someday. Scott Hendrickson is going into the military. He wants to be an Army Ranger. But whatever life holds for them, they'll always be linked by a moment and a gift they both say they'll treasure forever. For NPR News, I'm Dave DeWitt in Durham, North Carolina.
Whether you've read novelist Ann Patchett before or never read her, she's a writer who will take you someplace you've never been. Patchett has by now established herself in American fiction as a novelist of many gifts who can transform unlikely elements into mesmerizing plot, as she did in Bel Canto in 2002, in which she blended terrorism and opera. Now, several other acclaimed books, and almost a decade later, Patchett is out with a new novel called State of Wonder. And Patchett, it is a great pleasure to have you back on NPR again.
I'm very glad to be here.
You know, as I was reading this, I thought State of Wonder is packed with so much to talk about, so many plot lines, and so many fantastic things that happen. It's going to keep book groups happy all summer.
I hope so.
Would you just sort of talk about the beginning, talk about the mission of your heroine, Marina Singh?
Marina Singh is a pharmacologist who works in Minnesota, and she does studies on cholesterol, and her office mate of 7 years, Anders Ekman, has been sent to the Amazon to find out what's going on with a major research project that the company is funding, and while he is away, he dies. So when the book opens, she's just getting the news that her friend has died in the Amazon, and the company asks that she now go down there both to find out what's going on with the drug and to find out how Anders died.
You make the Amazon come so alive. I mean, I could practically smell it. Would you read a description of the Amazon for us, please?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Her scalp was soaked, her underwear. The ground beneath her feet loosened as streams of water sluiced between the trees. They heard a high whistle piercing through the thunder and wondered if it was their imagination. Imagination played a major role in the jungle, especially during a storm. They stopped and waited until the whistle came again and then a silence. Marina turned her head and saw that what she had taken for a tree to her left was actually a pole. There were four poles, and 5 feet above her head there was a platform, and above that platform a palm roof. Four Lakashi leaned over the edge, watching. Dr. Nkomo looked up, waved, and the four waved back.
Now, the Lakashi are a tribe, a fictional tribe, at the heart of this. But I just want to ask before we get to them, did you go to the Amazon, I kept wondering, to research any of this?
I did. For the first 3 days, I thought it was the most extraordinarily beautiful, fascinating, all-encompassed, gorgeous place I had ever been to in my life. But unfortunately, I stayed for 10 days. And by the end, I was pulling my hair out. I wanted to get out of there so badly.
Because you were sick because of the bugs, the heat?
No, it was so claustrophobic. It's just so oppressive. The jungle squeezes in on you from every side, and you can't go anywhere by yourself. You can't just say, I really want to have a moment and get away. I'm going to go take a walk. You can't take a walk unless you have a guide with you, because there are so many little tiny things out there that can kill you.
Which you do a brilliant job of describing. And I just want to get back to Marina. Who is she trying to find? We had started to talk about this secret drug that's being developed for Vogel, and it's being developed by her former intimidating mentor, a 70-something female doctor called Anique Swenson.
Yes. Dr. Swenson was Marina's teacher in medical school, and Marina was both terrified of her, in awe of her, wanted to shape her life in order to please Dr. Swenson. I think this is probably a pretty common case in medical school, in residency, that you have the sort of terrifying overlord and then a group of young students who will do anything to please and toe the line.
She's a great character. I mean, I kind of adored her. She's really crusty. I kept thinking of Katharine Hepburn in The African Queen. I also kind of thought she's sort of like a more benign version of Mr. Kurtz, Joseph Conrad's rogue ivory trader in The Heart of Darkness.
It's true. And a lot of people have been saying, oh, this is Heart of Darkness for women, which definitely Heart of Darkness figures into this book, but so do about five other novels.
I'm really glad you said that, though, Ann Patchett, because if you hadn't said that, I was going to have to call you on that and tell you you're
Oh, listen, I own up to my plagiarism fully. Evelyn Waugh, Handful of Dust, Henry James, The Ambassadors. It's all in there.
All right. So Anik Swenson's mission, I think we can say this without giving anything away, you let me know. Dr. Swenson is developing a drug based on tree bark eaten by the women of this fictional tribe. Yeah, I mean, you wrote it. And
these
women are astonishing because they have lifelong fertility. Boy, that struck me as interesting terrain.
That's very funny because whenever I've given a talk in the last year and somebody asks me what I'm working on and I say, oh, it's a book about a tribe in the Amazon where the women have everlasting fertility. And the women in the audience gasp and recoil in horror. And I always say, yes, it is a horror novel. But, you know, this is a very isolated tribe. They're cut off from everyone. And these women have no idea that all women in the world don't have fertility forever.
What are you saying about our society here? At first, I thought women, everlasting fertility, why go there?
Well, it does seem that women want to keep all of their options open forever. So it's a bit of a cautionary tale. I do think there's so much discussion about how you can freeze your eggs, you can get a surrogate, you can have children as late as you want. And this is a story in which I say, yes, you can have children as long as you want, but in fact, it doesn't really look so good.
Marina is also a heroine that I think we'd all like to emulate. She's in her early 40s. She's smart, brave, funny. She loses every gadget and possession she's got, barely ever looks in the mirror. You gave us a reluctant adventurer who somehow thrives.
It's true. She is reluctant, and she doesn't want this to happen to her. There's a moment in the book where she says she prays for this cup of Brazil to pass over her. But she finds out so much about herself. She just does what she has to do. So I think that Marina is a good role model. She's telling us if you're thrown off a cliff and into an ocean, you're going to figure out how to swim.
You know, I also love the relationship between the two women, the older Anik Swenson, the younger Marina Singh. Anik Swenson tells Marina at one point, the brain is a storage shed. You put experience in there and it waits for you. And I wondered if that holds true for you as a writer, because you put together so many elements, including here in all your novels, I think, and you make a really compelling story where one would think it might not work.
I think that is really true for me, because every single time I'm writing a book, I get to a certain place where I think, I cannot do this. I can't pull this off. And the only thing that keeps me going is the knowledge that I have always pulled it off before. And so that ability must be in me somewhere. The hardest book for me to write was my first book, because I didn't know that about myself. I wasn't sure I'd be able to make it. But now every time I come up against the wall of my own doubt, I think this is that moment where you come up against your doubt and you always push through and you always find your way.
Ann Patchett. Her newest novel is called State of Wonder. You can read an excerpt at npr.org. She joined us from Nashville. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Thanks so much.
Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolf visited the Mediterranean recently and while there found a Sicilian surprise.
I went for the Greek and Roman ruins, not for the food. I thought I'd find what I affectionately call New Jersey Italian, heavy tomato sauces. So imagine my surprise when I tried the national dish of Sicily. Pasta con le sarde is fresh sardines and pine nuts, currants, saffron, and fennel. Huh? Sicily has been conquered by every civilization since the ancient Greeks. Phoenicians, Romans, Arabs, Normans, Spanish, and French all added a little something to a native Mediterranean diet already a few thousand years ahead of its time. Plus, nature brings a lot to the table. Under the hot Sicilian sun, grapes, fava beans, artichokes, leeks, tomatoes, and loads of oranges and lemons thrive through the long growing season. Capers the size of olives grow out of cracks in ancient amphitheaters. Greek ruins are overgrown with wild fennel. The Greeks brought their love of fish to this island bordered by three seas. Tuna and swordfish are staples, but you also find squid stuffed with fava beans, pasta with dried tuna roe, mint, and tiny strawberries, or a sauce of cuttlefish and pistachios. The Romans brought wheat, and the Spanish added tomatoes, potatoes, and peppers. But the Arabs who came in the 9th century AD left the deepest culinary imprint. For one thing, they brought eggplant. Major gift. The number of Sicilian eggplant dishes is stunning. Fried, braised, stuffed. Sicilian caponata, a sweet and sour eggplant dish with celery, olives, capers, and tomato sauce, may be the best thing I've ever eaten. Honey was the sweetener of choice. Then the Arabs brought sugarcane. The Sicilians never looked back. Pastry shop windows are loaded with lifelike marzipan fruits, cannoli, and cookies with pine nuts, sesame seeds, and pistachios. A lot of sweets are made in convents and monasteries with oddly irreverent names like the pistachio buns called Chancellor's Buttocks, tarts named Virgin's Breasts, or the elaborate cake called Triumph of Gluttony. Gelato in brioche can be breakfast in Sicily. But this banquet has coexisted with abject poverty. So at the end of the 19th century, millions of southern Italians, many from Sicily, emigrated to America. Without familiar ingredients, they improvised and created an Italian-American cuisine. And one more nation adds to Sicily's rich stew pot.
Bonnie Wolfe is working on a book about another seashore, the foods of Maryland's Eastern Shore. This is NPR News. This morning in Paris, Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer renewed their rivalry in the French Open final. Spain's Nadal continued his dominance on the clay courts, dismissing Federer in four sets. This is Nadal's sixth French Open victory in the last 7 years. Federer fell to Nadal, the top-ranked men's player. He hit more aces and winners, but Switzerland's aging champ couldn't find his control, and he committed an egregious 56 unforced errors. The match capped off a magical tournament for Nadal, who hadn't lost a set in his last five matches, since outlasting John Isner in the tournament's first round. On the women's side, China's Li Na defeated Francesca Schiavone to become the first player from Asia to win a Grand Slam event. And after handily winning the first set, Li squandered a 4-2 lead in the second set. Schiavone forced a tiebreaker but lost seven straight points to hand Li the title. In China, the People's Daily headline read, "Li Na reached the summit of the Grand Slam," and underneath, a picture of the champion kissing her trophy.